Peter B. Collins, News and Comments. Day 2 of the New Dark Ages. It's Thursday, November 10th, 2016. Donald Trump met with Barack Obama at the White House today. They spent 90 minutes together. So I guess we got to get used to it. The transition is underway. We begin today with several pieces of commentary about the Trump election. And I want to start with a young man named Trent Lipinski. He is a millennial, a blogger, a guy who's been successful already in the tech industry, and in full disclosure, I have to tell you that I've known Trent since he was a little kid. He is the son of one of my good friends, Tom Lipinski, and I just yesterday, through a Facebook link, found a copy of his post called Dear Democrats. Read this if you don't understand why Trump won. And as of this hour, more than 5.7 million people have read this post by Trent Lipinski. And I'm tickled to see that. I also think that he is very accurate in his analysis. And he opens by asking his Democratic readers, did you read WikiLeaks? And then he answers the question, well, you should have. He says those conspiracies were true, and the mainstream media lied to you to, well, just about everything. He says, he argues that WikiLeaks was not Russian propaganda, that WikiLeaks has a 10-year record of never releasing a single falsified document, and it's not connected to Russia. I agree with him. I haven't seen any substantive proof of that, and lacking that, I am not persuaded by the arguments that came from the Clinton campaign that were buttressed by vague comments from the Director of National Intelligence, a proven perjurer, who appeared to be trying to tilt the election in the favor of Hillary Clinton, perhaps to hold on to his job. Well, we'll talk about that in a bit. But young Trent Lipinski continues, by not listening to your fellow Americans and accusing them of being conspiracy theorists and trusting the corporate media, you ignored reality. By only following other liberals on social media and only reading liberal or corporate news, once again, ignoring reality. When Hillary Clinton was caught rigging the primary against Bernie Sanders and Democrats nominated her anyway, they ignored reality. Everyone was simply insulating themselves within their own echo chamber, ignoring anything outside their bubble. And I think that is an excellent comment. I saw it, witnessed it time and time again. And it's interesting because some of the sharpest protagonists that I tangled with on Facebook the last few months, who called me sexist because I failed to support Hillary Clinton, because I raised legitimate objections about her candidacy, they have all announced, well, there are two of them, they have both announced that they're taking time off from Facebook to lick their wounds. I guess they want to stay in that bubble. Lipinski goes on, the media lied to us about everything. And he says, if you've been following my Twitter or Facebook account during this election, you probably would have thought I was a Trump supporter. However, I'm a former registered Democrat, a Bernie supporter, and consider myself a progressive libertarian. This was the first election I ended up voting third party, but my second choice was Trump. I simply could not vote for Hillary Clinton because of her mishandling of classified information and stealing the nomination from the people's choice, Bernie Sanders. Now, I believe there are other important issues too, but this is Trent's commentary, and I don't disagree with those particular points. He goes on, Hillary never should have been nominated in the first place. The first clue was when she was under FBI investigation. The second was when she rigged the primary elections. In an attempt to inform my friends, family, and followers, I posted dozens, if not hundreds, of WikiLeaks emails. I did this because most of my followers are liberals, and I realized they were all living in an echo chamber on social media where they were not being exposed to differing opinions or views. I took it upon myself to understand Trump and his supporters. What I found was millions of Americans who had been disenfranchised, normal people like you and I, who didn't recover from the Great Recession. They're pissed off about Obamacare, endless wars, trade deals that have killed jobs, higher taxes, a rigged economy, and they are not wrong, he argues. Had Democrats taken the concerns of average Americans seriously, especially those of millennials, they would have quickly realized that Hillary Clinton was not the right nominee for the Democratic Party this year. In the next paragraph, talking about Sanders, he says the reason Clinton did not win this election is because she never should have been nominated in the first place. There was a better choice. And he argues pretty clearly that was Bernie Sanders. He talks about the people who were isolated online hearing from paid Hillary trolls. And we have evidence. We have trolls who went public, who blew the whistle on David Brock's super PAC called Correct the Record. And they were out there with a vengeance. And Trent noted that his blog post here went viral, partly because Correct the Record is no longer operating. So I think this is a really strong piece, and I encourage you to read it and let me know what you think. He also links to some of his earlier posts where he echoes comments that I've made, suspecting that this argument that Russia hacked the DNC and John Podesta is a concoction, or at least it is an assertion for which no evidence has been provided. I also want to note a critique of social media, Facebook in particular, written by Joshua Benton and published yesterday. And he says, you know, I'm from a small town in South Louisiana. The day before the election, I looked at the Facebook page of the current mayor of my town. Among the items he posted, Hillary Clinton calling for civil war if Trump is elected. Pope Francis shocks world, endorses Donald Trump for president. Barack Obama admits he was born in Kenya. FBI agent who was suspected of leaking Hillary's corruption is dead. And Benson says these are not legit anti-Hillary stories. There are plenty of those, but these are lies. They're made up. They're frauds. And Facebook was filled with them during this election campaign, and many of them were pro-Hillary lies. I also got, my inbox is so relieved that most of the emails from BoldPack have stopped coming. But there were a lot of pro-Hillary messages out there, for example, exonerating her of any crimes or misdeeds in the email investigation, and that was as untrue as some of this crap about Trump. Naomi Klein published a piece at The Guardian today saying that it's the Democrats' embrace of neoliberalism that won it for Trump, and I think this is quite a compelling analysis. She opens by saying they, Democratic supporters, will blame James Comey and the FBI. They'll blame voter suppression and racism. They'll blame Bernie or bust and misogyny. They'll blame third parties and independent candidates. They'll blame the corporate media and WikiLeaks. But this leaves out the force most responsible for creating the nightmare in which we now find ourselves wide awake. Neoliberalism, that worldview, fully embodied by Hillary Clinton and her machine, is no match for Trump-style extremism. The decision to run one against the other is what sealed our fate. And she begs, can we please learn from that mistake? Here's what we need to understand, Klein writes. A hell of a lot of people are in pain. Under neoliberal policies of deregulation, privatization, austerity, and corporate trade, their living standards have declined precipitously. They've lost jobs, pensions, homes. They see a future for their kids even worse than their precarious present. And I think that, and I'm injecting my own view here now, that Obama failed very obviously to pin the blame for the economic meltdown, the subsequent moves, including TARP, the bailout for Wall Street, the bailout for Detroit, on failed Republican economic policies. And so going into this election cycle, many people just blamed Obama because he is the resident of the White House, and that's how it normally occurs. But I think there are clear factors that, slowed down the economic recovery, and that not all of that can be blamed on Democrats. But Klein goes on to say, Trump's message was, all is hell. Clinton answered, all is well, but it's not well, far from it. So I encourage you to read both of these pieces. I think it's very interesting to see their takes on the underlying factors that led to this, at least for too many people, unexpected outcome. Michael Moore, on Election Day, reverted to, the old Michael Moore. You know, the fat guy with a baseball cap. who spoke for working people. And I have to say that Michael Moore lowered my respect for him by pimping for Hillary Clinton, but he wasn't alone. Robert Reich, the former labor secretary, who wrote incredibly strong pieces supporting and advancing the cause of Bernie Sanders, well, he closed ranks and was pushing people very hard to support Hillary in the final days. And Bill Maher deserves special rebuke for the way he, just embraced the Hillary candidacy, even though he allowed Bernie Sanders to come back on his show. He just really shut down anybody who wanted to raise questions about Hillary's electability on his Friday night show. So I don't judge people for how they vote, and I also believe that under these circumstances, many people like Reich and Michael Moore made difficult choices to back these candidates. Let's add Rob Reiner to this mix as well. At any rate, Michael Moore has reverted to his more original form, and in a Facebook post on the day after the election, he argued that it's time to take over the Democratic Party and return it to the people. They have failed us miserably. Fire all the pundits, predictors, pollsters, and anyone else in the media who had a narrative they wouldn't let go of. Well, Michael, you bought into those narratives. You promoted those narratives. All right. He goes on to say that Democratic politicians who have been in the leadership should step out of the way. Unless they're willing to fight, resist, and obstruct in the way Republicans did against Obama every day for 8 full years. And I do think it is time for a change of the guard. My old friend Nancy Pelosi should step down as the minority leader of the Democrats, and she shouldn't just hand it off to Steny Hoyer. They should open it up for a good, younger, firebrand progressive. And I'm thinking of somebody like Keith Ellison, who should take over the party and reshape it to reconnect with the original base that was abandoned by the Clintons going back to 1992 and their whole pro-corporate Democratic Leadership Council. And it has spawned the problems that the Democratic Party faces today. One other comment or quote from Michael Moore. He says that people must stop saying that they're stunned and shocked, saying, what you mean to say is that you were in a bubble and weren't paying attention to your fellow Americans and their despair. Once again, Michael, some of those people were paying attention to you. That meeting in the Oval Office today lasted about 90 minutes, and the president and his successor came out and spoke briefly to the press with a lot of happy talk. Obama said, I want to emphasize, Mr. President-elect, that we now are going to do everything we can to help you succeed, because if you succeed, then the country succeeds. And these are old rhetorical saws that we have heard so many times before. And I don't think that any of the people who utter them are sincere. But that's the form that you must adopt as a professional politician. So Melania got a tour of the living quarters by Michelle Obama. I wonder if they talked about breast implants. I'm sorry, that's inappropriate, but I have a real hard time accepting Melania Trump as a serious figure of any sort. The description is that Obama appeared to be stiff and subdued throughout the exchange with Trump, and Trump rambled thusly, we discovered a lot of different situations, some wonderful and some difficulties. I very much look forward to dealing with the president in the future, including counsel. He explained some of the difficulties, some of the high-flying assets, and some of the really great things that have been achieved. And after that, Press Secretary Josh Earnest was unable to decode what Trump said or what he meant by high-flying assets, but maybe they talked about drones. At any rate, this is how the process works. It's better than a coup or a revolution or a military takeover, but it is hard to stomach. Thousands of people feel that way all across the country as protests have broken out the last couple of nights, starting across the bay from me in Oakland, but Dallas, Texas, Boston, Chicago, Portland, Oregon, Seattle, Washington, D.C., campuses here in California, Massachusetts, and Pennsylvania. In Oakland yesterday, the crowd doubled from 3,000 to 6,000 within an hour, and there were some problems with some hooligans who started fires in the street and broke windows. A couple of cops were suffering minor injuries. In Los Angeles, students from UCLA started a protest in Brentwood, and other protesters burned a Trump effigy at City Hall and shut down a section of Highway 101. It was interesting to me watching MSDNC last night because Rachel Maddow devoted a lot of airtime to showing pictures of these various protests. And I don't object to that. What I object to is that, and I'm watching MSNBC a lot less than I used to, but I haven't seen any substantial coverage of the protest, the long-running protest, at Standing Rock, North Dakota. That, of course, would be objected to by the American Petroleum Institute, which is a major advertiser on MSNBC. So the selective coverage of protests, also a lot of the Black Lives Matter protests, have been selectively covered by MSNBC and other networks as well. So I just wanted to offer that kind of critical, skeptical comment. Every day I like to pause for a moment and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Aidan McAleer and Margaret Anderson made a very touching special contribution in honor of my mother, who passed away about 10 days ago. Margaret, special thanks for your thoughtfulness. I really do appreciate it. Andy Krieger is an ongoing subscriber, and so is Grant Gibson. Thanks to each and every one of you, and keep them coming. I do need some new subscribers to replace those who bailed on me this year because of my critical coverage of the Hillary Clinton campaign. And now that that's behind us, Gary Kane, it's safe for you to come on back from New Jersey. There are many others who I know checked out because of my clear point of view. And I hope that we can all come together here. And if you're ready to take out a new subscription, come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page where it's easy. It just takes a couple of minutes. And I always like to remind you that we're now feeding our daily news and comment podcast to YouTube, which appears on almost every phone and device. Makes it very easy for you to find. Click on the subscribe button on the YouTube page. It's free, but that way you can get notifications each time I post a new podcast. Well, here on the left coast, there is a sense of shock, and there is little awe for Donald Trump. And there was already a movement, a small group here in California, that had talked about seceding from the United States. Now there is renewed talk of this, and the media is covering it mostly as a feature story. And there is one proposal to create the nation of Pacifica, comprised of the current entities known as Washington State, Oregon, and California. It would include 55 million people. It would represent the world's fifth largest economy. It's the center of technology, entertainment, and an agricultural powerhouse. But let's be realistic. To secede from the Union, the states involved would have to approve it by two-thirds, and then the Congress would have to let us out. And that requires a two-thirds vote as well. So I think it's extremely far-fetched, and frankly, I'm not going to put a lot of time or attention into it. Tomorrow, I'm scheduled to record an in-depth interview with our friend Greg Palast, who provided excellent coverage of the election this year, argued that the interstate cross-check list was one of the suppression tactics that kept Democrats from voting, and I'll be eager to hear Greg's comments on what actually happened on election night. Here is a new report that's just been compiled by Jonathan Simon, who is a very credible election integrity activist who I've talked with many times over the years. And he analyzes the exit polls from Tuesday night, and he strongly suspects that Donald Trump's allies did, in fact, rig the election in his favor. In critical states like North Carolina, He shows an almost 6% shift in favor of Trump between the exit polls and the final results announced. In Pennsylvania, a 5.6% shift in favor of Trump. In Wisconsin, which Trump narrowly won by 1%, the shift predicted here or projected by Jonathan Simon is 4.9%. A couple more. Florida, where the margin in Trump's favor is 1.3%. Simon identifies a shift from the exit polls to the published tally of 2.6%. In Michigan, it appears to be the margin of victory. Now, at this point, Michigan is not finalized and has not been added to the Electoral College tally. But Simon shows a 0.3% shift in favor of Trump, and that produced the 0.3% lead that he currently enjoys. Likewise, in Minnesota, where Hillary Clinton won by 1.4%, there is a 1.5% shift in favor of Trump. Now, for me, this is not proof, but it invites deeper investigation. Now, there are issues about whether the exit polls can be relied upon. They come from Edison Research, a corporate entity, and the exit polls are often massaged to try to match the official tally. So we have to confirm that these are uncorrected exit poll numbers, and we also need a final tally, which is not in place in many states. But this early analysis does give, I think, important pause, and this is another issue that I'll talk with Greg Pallast about in our interview coming up tomorrow. Now, I can already hear people who found it convenient to blame Ralph Nader for Al Gore's loss in 2000 and shift to the present and say that it was Jill Stein who denied Hillary Clinton the margin she needed in several battleground states. Only, it's not true. First of all, Jill Stein and the Green Party averaged 1% of the vote in the states where they were on the ballot. And I went through most of the competitive states and looked last evening. And in each case, the vote for Jill Stein was not a spoiler for the Hillary Clinton candidacy. Now, you could argue that Gary Johnson, who averaged 3% of the popular vote, got higher in some states, a little lower in others, may have had an impact, but I'm hard-pressed to believe that people who were inclined to vote for Hillary Clinton decided that Gary Johnson was a better choice for them. I'm sure there are some examples, but it's hard to imagine that that was a widespread phenomenon. And in Oregon, I saw that Jill Stein did have 2% of the vote, but again, it did not impact the margin that Hillary Clinton won with in Oregon. So the real issue for me is in the big picture of turnout. 7 million fewer Democrats turned out to vote this year than did in 2012. And we'll find out in the coming days exactly who those people are. But the lack of enthusiasm for Hillary Clinton, the negatives that she has been known to carry even before her self-inflicted wounds from the email scandal, I think, are the real factors in play. Now, there are also the attitudes of white female voters, because overall, 53% of white women voted for Donald Trump. And white women without a college degree supported Trump over Clinton by nearly a 2-to-1 margin. So it appears that some of these women are pro-life, and they actually believe Donald Trump is going to end abortion rights in this country. That's not a proven notion. He certainly has said it. But his history is that he was a pro-choice Democrat. So it's anybody's guess what he will actually do. But that could be one reason why women would overlook his obvious sexism, misogyny, and claims of groping and say, well, he's going to do things that I support, you know, like putting pro-life justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. Here are a couple of quotes. Laurie Jones, outside New York City, said, "I was delighted to vote for Trump because he's a pro-life advocate." Here's a Catholic mother of two from Dallas, Lizzie Whitmire. I voted for Trump because America has struggled with simple economics and needs a change. I also want someone who is angry about terrorism and radical Islam. Okay. And here is the same woman in a second quote. To me, Hillary's cover-up story on Benghazi and repeated lies to the American people are extremely corrupt. She took responsibility for the security at the compound that left four Americans killed, and we're talking about Trump's language and behavior. Trump has never killed people and lied about it. And here's another quote from Noemi Martinez, who voted for Trump in Phoenix. She said, Hillary's been there so many years, and what has she done? She lies. Trump has a few issues, but people change. I figure it's take a liar or take a chance, and I figure take a chance. There's also the unspoken issue of how women perceive other women who aspire to leadership. And I don't have any science or data or polling information on this, only my own experience that there are many women who are deeply suspicious of other women who are their supervisors or superiors. And I think that some of this plays out. I'd be interested in your comments, especially my female listeners. Do you think that some of these attitudes that women harbor toward other women were a factor? Over at Vice News, Jason Leopold has a piece based on anonymous sources in the intelligence community saying that they dread Donald Trump's presidency. He notes that back in August, there were 50 former national security and foreign policy officials who signed on to a letter vehemently opposing Trump's presidency, or his candidacy at that time. They said he would be a dangerous president and would put at risk our country's national security and well-being. Now, several U.S. counterterrorism officials told Jason Leopold, and again, he's not naming them, that there's a sense of dread in the intelligence community over Trump's victory and disgust over the fact that he has been harshly critical of their assessments on Syria and Russia, particularly the finding that Russia is responsible for cyber attacks in the U.S. Now, here's a case where I agree with Trump. We don't have any evidence, and we have tainted people like James Clapper, who made this bizarre statement where he didn't actually say he knew Russia did the hacking. He just said that it was consistent with their behavior. And this was amplified into a comment from Hillary Clinton in the final debate that 17 intelligence agencies had cleared her and had stated that Russia did this. It's not really true. There isn't proof of that. And if it does become true, I will eat some rubles or make some other dramatic gesture to let you know that I was wrong. But so far, I think that I am correct, and I remain skeptical. So I think the biggest issue is that John Brennan at the CIA and Jimmy Clapper at the DNI, Director of National Intelligence, are worried about their jobs. And they know that they tipped their hands politically to try to tilt the election to Hillary Clinton. And they know that they're vulnerable to a vengeful guy like Donald Trump. Here's another intelligence official, unnamed. We didn't realize this was a real possibility. There's a whole slew of things we don't have a firm sense of at this point. Now, these are the people who are supposed to have their fingers on the pulse. They're listening to our phone calls. They're reading our emails. They've got all our metadata. And they didn't even think it was a real possibility that Trump could win? I think we have to retire the name intelligence from our spy community. Jason also notes that it is unlikely that Guantanamo will be closed, and that Trump may actually be the president who puts new prisoners into Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. There's been a spike of hate crimes reported just in the last 48 hours since the election. At San Diego State U, a Muslim woman who was wearing a hijab told campus police that two men pulled up, jumped out of a car, made comments about Muslims and Trump before robbing her of her purse, her backpack, and her car keys. And they don't say in the news account here that the car was stolen. They say that she could not then locate her car. Over at the University of Louisiana, two men reportedly beat, robbed, and ripped off the hijab of a female Muslim student One of the attackers reported to have been wearing a white hat with Trump written on it. And there are other incidents as well. Twitter has painted a picture of divided high schools as students shared incidents ranging from African Americans being called cotton pickers to Latinos being told to leave the country. In Pennsylvania, one principal held a special assembly after reports of students yelling homophobic slurs, calling black students cotton pickers, and using Hitler salutes. So this is an issue that we have to really keep tabs on, because I think that Trump has unleashed a lot of hate, and that there are a lot of people out there who see that as license to haze, harass, and even injure people who aren't white and Trump supporters. And finally today, looking for that silver lining in this ugly election outcome, well, many pundits are saying that the current version of the Trans-Pacific Partnership is dead, and that Trump will attempt to renegotiate it when he takes office on January 20th. I hope it is dead, and I don't particularly have any desire to see it renegotiated. But I also suspect, as I referenced yesterday, that President Obama will look for a way to align with or collude with Republicans in the lame duck session that starts next week to find some kind of a deal that he can offer to give Republicans something that they've been demanding and Obama has been refusing in exchange for passage of the TPP. So this is one I think we should remain vigilant on. I got an email this morning from the friend of a friend who wants to try to pressure the Republicans to move forward on the Supreme Court nomination of Merrick Garland. And that's dead. And the Republicans are emboldened now. There's no way to leverage them. We know they can't be shamed into doing their duty in the Senate. And so the one issue where I think there is some possible action, and we need to be quite vigilant, is a sneaky effort to pass the TPP in the lame duck session. Thanks for joining me for my free news and comment podcast today. I invite you to share it far and wide and remind you it's available on YouTube.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.